From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. E-cigarette sales have exploded in the past few years and now account for almost half of the total cigarette market in the U.S. These popular devices are controversial, though, and new research highlights both the potential benefits for established smokers and the potential dangers for adolescents. Also, as the problem of antibiotic-resistant infections looms large, a new analysis suggests a surprising approach. Worry less about finding new ways to treat deadly infections and focus instead on minor ones, like UTIs and strep. And finally, we'll wrap up the hour with a look ahead at some of the science stories you can expect to hear about in the coming year. Well, whatever the rest of 2018 may hold in store, it has already started off with some attention-grabbing weather, and that's where we begin today. The last week of December and the first week of January brought record-setting cold to the Northeast. Joining me now to talk about what's causing this cold streak is Sean Burkle. He's the Maine State climatologist and research assistant professor at University of Maine's Climate Change Institute. Sean, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. It's very good to be here.
It's not just that it's been intensely cold over the past couple of weeks, but it's kind of stayed that way for, you know, days at a time and most of the past 2 weeks. How unusual is this cold spell?
Well, from a historical perspective, going back a century or so, there are comparable cold waves. There were a few in the early 1900s, also in the 1970s. And there was something similar that happened just in 2015 in the month of February. There was a pretty significant cold snap that affected central and eastern United States. It's certainly much more rare now and in recent years than it was in decades past. And there are some unusual aspects of this, and one being if we look at a global map of a temperature departure from normal climatology, there is a very focused cold anomaly, is what we would call it, over North America primarily, whereas much of the rest of the globe shows normal or above normal temperatures. And it's a pretty stark contrast between the cold over North America and, say, for example, the warmth that's most everywhere else, particularly over Eurasia. And cold waves in the past may not have had that same expression.
You mentioned the cold spell in 2015, and that's when a lot of us got introduced to the phrase polar vortex. Is that the same thing that's going on now? What's driving this cold spell?
Well, the polar vortex is simply circulation over the polar regions. And the term was used in a way in the media that really sensationalized. It was really just circulation. But that is when the term entered into the media, and it was the most significant cold snap in many years in the across the country. And but the circulation pattern is very similar. And in 2015, there was a pronounced ridge that some had called the ridiculously resilient ridge of warm air over the Pacific Northwest. And downstream of that, this would be at the jet stream level, downstream of that, a deep trough. And that's where we find the Arctic air dipping down. And a very similar pattern has persisted over the past 2 weeks. Very strong ridging over the western part of the continent or the Pacific Northwest, bringing very warm air into Alaska. Downstream trough developing. And what's happening is warm air is being pushed over Alaska into the Arctic. Cold air has to be displaced, so it's being displaced into the middle latitudes. But at the same time, on the other side of the North Pole, there's also warm circulation over Eurasia. And the circulation happens to be that right now most of the cold air is being funneled down into North America, particularly over central Canada, central U.S., and eastern U.S.
I'm talking with Sean Burkle. He's Maine State climatologist and a research assistant professor at University of Maine's Climate Change Institute. You've got this website, Climate Reanalyzer, that shows maps of everything we've been talking about. And if you look at the temperature right now, what it shows is, like you said, this kind of tongue. It looks almost like the Arctic has kind of spilled out of the Arctic and down into the eastern part of North America. There are places where the temperature
like in Ontario and Quebec, is the same as the temperature at the North Pole. And while those temperatures are really cold for us here in the Northeast, they're actually really warm for the Arctic. I mean, it's like 3.5 degrees Celsius warmer than usual in the Arctic. What's the connection between the Arctic being so much warmer and us being so much colder than usual?
Well, one thing to bear in mind, there will always be weather. So even though the globe is warming, particularly the surface oceans are warming, this has been observed. Arctic sea ice is declining, this has been observed. The Arctic is warming very rapidly, it's been observed. But there's still weather, and weather can produce some pretty remarkable patterns. And even in the Arctic, you'd be surprised to see that just weather, forgetting climate warming for just for now, there can be weather events in which these loops in the jet stream can transport warm air into very high latitudes. So that part is not particularly unusual. However, the long-term trend does show significant warming over the Arctic. It shows that very warm air incursions are becoming more frequent. So while it may not be incredibly unusual to see temperatures near freezing in parts of the Arctic midwinter, it appears to be happening with greater frequency. And last year, for example, there was a brief period where the North Pole got above freezing. That's a pretty rare event, but it's happened a few times, most recently in the past 10 years or so. And so there's the aspect of weather and then the climate. We should think of climate as being average weather, and it's most important to look at long-term trends. Isolated weather events, though, we have to be careful with how we understand those. We need the broader context of a long-term historical trend.
So are you saying this is basically just a weather event and we shouldn't read too much into it? We shouldn't, you know, think that perhaps this is what winters may increasingly be like as the planet continues to warm, and the Arctic in particular warms so rapidly?
There may be a climate significance because the Arctic has warmed significantly. Again, it's been observed, and recent research suggests that declining Arctic sea ice and a warming of the Arctic is linked to a changing poleward gradient from the equator to pole, which is reducing the circulation and making what are called blocking patterns become more frequent. Blocking patterns can give rise to extreme events such as heat waves and cold waves, and it's possible that what we're seeing is a trend to a new climatic regime. However, there is still weather, and we should be careful on picking an isolated weather event and trying to make a climate case out of it. Again, it's about long-term trends, and are certain phenomena becoming more frequent? Are they becoming more intense? And it is possible that cold waves like this, perhaps they will become more frequent. And perhaps there is a linkage to declining Arctic sea ice and a shallowing of the polar gradient. And this is an area of active research. Researchers are trying to understand better what the future may bring. And they do this by using numerical models, global climate models, and also by comparing output from those models to historical data sets and trying to flesh out how, say, 20 or 30 or 50 years from now, how conditions might be. And will cold events such as this, will it become more frequent? I think it's an open question.
For most of us, this cold snap has us, you know, thinking, is it too cold to go skiing or go for a walk? As a climatologist, though, I wonder, does an event like this spark questions? What kinds of research questions might come out of this period of unusually cold weather?
Well, I think it will be very instructive to identify comparable events in the historical record, because that will help give us context for what we're seeing, and then to closely see how climate models might be reproducing similar events in future scenarios.
That's Sean Berkel. He's a research assistant professor at University of Maine's Climate Change Institute and Maine's state climatologist. Thanks so much, and stay warm.
Great. Thank you. You too.
Of course, the one break in the cold came on Wednesday and Thursday in the form of a powerful winter storm that hit New England. It brought snow and high winds, but the really big story was historic flooding
all the way from north of Boston right down to the Cape and Islands. Despite forecast calling for moderate to major coastal flooding, what actually happened went well beyond many expectations. So what happened? Glenn Field is warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Taunton. Glenn, what did happen? I mean, the warnings didn't look that different than usual. When we get a strong nor'easter, we expect major impacts in places like Scituate and Sandwich and Nantucket. But, I mean, Long Wharf in Boston underwater, downtown Provincetown awash. We haven't seen this kind of flooding for decades, and we've had some strong storms in recent years. So what was different this time around?
Well, first of all, thanks for inviting us to speak. I know there's a lot of questions, and this is a great opportunity to talk about what we mean by actual warnings and getting everybody to understand it a little better. We have statements, and then we have coastal flood advisories. And the third level that we have is something called the coastal flood warning. And there are moderate and major terminology. Minor coastal flooding, which wouldn't be a warning, is when we're expecting kind of nuisance flooding, splash over, that kind of thing. But when we use the term moderate coastal flooding, we're implying that there will be some structural damage as well as inundation, things like that. So you could have damage to piers and steps and people's decks, things like that. Major we reserve for something like the Blizzard of 78, which has complete destruction of structures, or actually houses fall into the ocean, or the walls are directly torn apart. So moderate is more of a disruption, and major is more of destruction. So what we had Thursday was more of a widespread disruption and inundation as opposed to the pure destruction type of thing. And it was very widespread. And some of the factors that led to it being so powerful was that we had a very rapidly deepening system. You've probably heard the term bombogenesis floated around. That's when a storm deepens what we call 1 millibar per hour or 24 millibars in a day. This storm deepened almost 50 millibars in a day. And so that's very deep and very rapid. Normally it takes a while to build up a fetch over the waters, to build up the seas over time, several tide cycles. But in this case, it was deepening so rapidly that the winds picked up very suddenly and the seas built up tremendously. We're also at high tide, astronomical tide for the month, and you notice there was a full moon. So the predicted astronomical tide in Boston was 12.1 feet, which is one of the higher tides in the month that we would normally get. But with this rapidly deepening system, we also had a 3-foot storm surge. So we hit 15.2 in Boston, which broke the record, 15.16, broke the record of 15.1, very close, set back in the blizzard of 78. That's the combination of the astronomical plus the storm surge. So that was a record, but just for comparison's sake, it wasn't anything like what we experienced in the blizzard of 78. That went through 4 tide cycles. This was only one. The seas at Boston Buoy hit 15 to 18 feet during this storm, but they were 35 feet in the blizzard of 78. So it's that wave action that actually did in structures, and that's where major flooding would be. But that's not to take away, certainly, a lot of inundation well inland and complicated by some sea ice as well. That just added even more trouble to the mix. When you get a rapidly deepening storm system, like I said, 50 millibars in 24 hours, generally 1 foot of ocean rise happens with every 30 millibars of pressure loss. So if there's less pressure on the ocean surface, it rises up. And so about 1 of the 3 feet that we had from storm surge was due to less pressure above it.
Well, so I was looking at some of the tide gauge data during the storm, and outside Boston Harbor and outside of Nantucket, the buoys were saying 1 to 1.5 feet above normal water level. And then, you know, you get inside Boston Harbor and inside Nantucket Harbor, and that's where we saw the full 3-foot surge.
Right.
Is that 1.5 feet? That's not from the wind. You're saying that's just from less pressure pushing down on the ocean?
Yeah, generally 1 foot of that would have been less pressure.
That is really amazing.
So that is, and that's because it does take time, generally, to build up the seas to a tremendous frenzy. And so that's why we only saw like 18-foot seas, which is, you know, certainly big and dangerous for mariners, but nothing like the 35-foot seas that we had back in the blizzard of 78. So it's a little bit misleading to say that, you know, to compare it. You know, technically, the water level rose up, but it was because it was at the maximum astronomical tide for the month. Technically, we did beat it. But it was certainly a powerful storm.
It sounds like you're saying that what happened on Thursday is pretty much what you forecast. I have to tell you, though, I spoke with a coastal geologist on Thursday evening who monitors a stretch of the Cape Cod Bay shoreline for state officials, and he said that it was, based on the forecast, he was surprised at the extent of flooding, and he kind of thought that on-the-ground observations from this storm might end up leading to some changes in some of the forecasting models going forward. Do you agree? Do you think there's some revisiting of the models to be done, or do you think you pretty much got this forecast right?
Well, some of the models that we look at were under forecasting the surge values. But what we do is use our expertise and actually beef them up in the public products and warnings that we issued. So we understand some of the shortcomings of the models themselves. And so that's where we add our local expertise. So if there's anything that I would say that we could have improved on this is the public messaging a little bit in terms of how extensive, not how intense it was, but how widespread, how extensive the area of inundation would be. So it got into a lot of homes. That's not to say it was any worse than what we were advertising, but I think, you know, when we issue a warning of any type, if it's a severe thunderstorm warning, warning is a bad thing. You know, if your mother says, "I'm warning you," you know that's a bad thing. So that's the highest level that we can issue. A warning is only issued when we're expecting at least moderate coastal flooding. And really, those are the terminology that we have, but it might be better if we call moderate bad and major really bad. You know, that way people know it's going to be bad. But that's what we mean when we have a moderate coastal flood warning.
Glenn Field is warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Taunton. Glenn, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Up next, the latest research on e-cigarettes. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.